All right, we're happy to hear argument in our second case, East Coast Repair versus USA, number 20-2146.
Good afternoon, and if it pleases the court, I'm Dustin Paul from Van Dievener Black on behalf of East Coast Repair and Fabrication. We come before the court for a reversal of the district court's entry of summary judgment and reversal of the district court's finding of a lack of subject matter jurisdiction. This case focuses on the repair contract to a Navy vessel, the USS Hurricane, in which my client, East Coast Repair, has never been paid the full contract balance for the work that it did on that vessel. And so it filed its suit in the Eastern District of Virginia, consistent with the Contract Disputes Act, seeking the unpaid balance on that contract. Its claims before the court were quite simple. It had a fixed price contract with the Navy. It performed as it was required to under the contract, and yet it had not been paid the full balance that was due under the contract. Based upon that, it issued its final invoice for nearly $500,000, and the Navy refused to pay it. That resulted in the suit that was filed in Norfolk. The claims are quite straightforward, and we believe, in fact, summary judgment should be entered on behalf of East Coast Repair, because the Navy and the government have never contested the underlying facts that support the claim in this case, the existence of the contract, the performance of the contract, and the failure to pay under the contract. Unfortunately, the district court went off in two directions that simply should not have resulted in summary judgment. The first one we have to address is the threshold matter, is the subject matter jurisdiction issue that the court ruled on. The district court ruled that it lacked subject matter jurisdiction to hear this claim because of the election doctrine, a doctrine that arises under the Contracts Dispute Act. The election doctrine is relatively straightforward as far as government contracting matters go. It requires that a party seeking to enforce a government contract elect one and only one jurisdiction to have a particular issue heard. So it can choose for a maritime contract like this to be heard in the district court, or where the contract is with the Navy, it can be heard before the Armed Services Board. In this case, East Coast has only elected to have these matters heard before the district court. Nevertheless, the district court concluded to the opposite, finding that East Coast had in fact elected to have these issues heard before the Armed Services Board. But that as a legal matter and a factual matter is simply incorrect. There was never a complaint or a notice of appeal on these issues that was filed before the Armed Services Board. Instead, what the government seeks to rely upon is an erroneously filed motion for summary judgment before the board. That motion for summary judgment, however, is not an election under the election doctrine. It is only the filing of a complaint or a notice of appeal on an issue that makes a binding election. The rules in front of the board are no different than the rules before every district court throughout this country. It is the complaint that frames the claims that are before the court. And in fact, if we look at Board Rule 6D, a matter that's not in the pleadings cannot be heard by the court unless there's agreement between the parties, and no one has alleged that here. Just like in a normal civil suit before a district court, matters raised in a motion for summary judgment, certainly here when that motion was erroneously filed, cannot somehow expand the issues that are before the court. Having there never been an actual election to proceed before the board, the district court here had subject matter jurisdiction to hear the claim. It's also important to note that the district court in this case never made any factual findings that would support a conclusion that the Armed Services Board had jurisdiction to hear a claim, even if it had been properly filed.
Mr. Paul, if I could ask you, I thought I understood part of your argument on the subject matter jurisdiction to be that the Navy had represented as a matter of fact that the liquidated damages claim was not presented before the board.
Indeed, Your Honor. They represented that both to the board and to the district court at separate instances, that this matter of the liquidated damages had never been before the board.
So is it part of your argument that as a factual matter that simply was never present and therefore there wasn't a basis for the district court to rule on? Or what is your argument?
Well, I think there's a number of arguments. The first one is that there's never been an election made. If there's never been an election made, the election doctrine can't apply. The second one is that even if there is an election made, that election only becomes binding upon a finding that the board or the court, whichever one was the first forum selected, actually has jurisdiction to hear the claim. That finding has never been made in this case. It was never made by the board because everybody told the board that these issues were never before the board. And it wasn't found by the district court here.
Okay, Mr. Paul, let's just say you're right on that. Why don't you have a problem arising from the settlement agreement in the Tempest case? Because in the Tempest litigation, and I'm referring you particularly to JA 257, page 5 of the complaint in the Tempest litigation, you said that the liquidated damages of $474,000 were part of the Tempest contract, that they're including those liquidated damages as part of the calculation of damages requested here under because they were assessed on the Tempest. And then when you settlement agreement, and that's the JA 85, page 2 of the settlement agreement, you agreed to settle any claims arising out of or in any way relating to the Tempest contract. So why doesn't that end the case here? You, in your own litigation under the Tempest lawsuit, said these liquidated damages are damages arising from Tempest. And then in settling the Tempest lawsuit, you said, we're giving up any claims that arising from or could have arisen from the Tempest contract. So why doesn't that end the matter?
Your Honor, I think it goes to the actual language that's within the settlement agreement on page 85 and page 86. So there is no reference in either of those sections to the hurricane case. There's no references to the hurricane contract. And in fact,
right,
I think
when they're talking about the contract, they're talking about the Tempest contract. That was right. The lawsuit they're settling.
That's exactly right. They settled the Tempest contract, but they didn't settle the claims on the hurricane contract.
Right. And they said that they were, but you pleaded in the Tempest litigation that these were damages that were part of the Tempest contract because they were assessed on the Tempest. You said that on at Appendix 257. So how do you get away from your own language in the complaint?
I think we do that by the actual language of the settlement agreement. And what I would note in particular is that the settlement agreement release of claims differentiated specifically between matters that arose in the Tempest litigation, which is what the government was releasing, and claims which arose under the Tempest contract. I think here it's important to apply what I would consider a but-for test. But for the existence of the Tempest contract, the claims of East Coast would be exactly the same. We have a lump sum contract. We did the work. We performed the work. We want to be paid for it. The only way that the Tempest issues really arise in the suit is as an affirmative defense raised by the government in this case. And that's an affirmative defense they no longer have because they've clearly released in the settlement agreement anything related to the Tempest filings. But here, there's a distinction between claims arising under the hurricane contract and claims arising under the Tempest contract. What we've asserted in this case are clearly claims arising under the hurricane contract. And I think when you compare the language in paragraph 2 and paragraph 3 of the settlement agreement, that distinction is clear. And I think what's important to note is throughout all of the briefing, both at the district court and here before this court, there's only been one suggested interpretation of those two paragraphs that make any sense. Why did the parties not agree to mirror image releases?
And the only reason— Excuse me, there's no evidence in this record from anybody who knew anything about signing these releases that this was intended, right?
Well, what we do know from the Fourth Circuit prior ruling is—
First answer my question, then you can go on.
That's correct. Neither party put any parole evidence. Both parties think the contract speaks for itself.
Right.
And here it does. We've got controlling Fourth Circuit precedent, which says that when different terms are used, if there's any possible interpretation in which the different meanings can be attributed, then that's what should be done. And I point the court to Hunter versus the town of Rockville.
I'm familiar with that precedent. I'm not sure it's applicable here. But can you go back to Judge Keenan's question and look at this language on 257?
Yeah, 257 of the joint appendix?
Mm-hmm.
To follow that point up, Mr. Paul, why doesn't that paragraph 23 on page 257 make the liquidated damages, I think this is Judge Keenan's question, part of the Tempest contract?
Because of the traditional rules regarding set-offs and affirmative defenses. I mean, to be clear, East Coast was within the suit trying to be clear that no money should have been taken away from the hurricane contract. I mean, that what was being litigated here in the underlying Tempest suit was whose responsibility it was for the late delivery of the Tempest. And a natural consequence of that was whether or not liquidated damages could be assessed. But what was not being adjudicated was what the actual contract balance was on the hurricane contract and the right to collect under the hurricane contract. Here, we've gotten focused from the actual claims that East Coast is making, which is for payment under the hurricane contracts, to a potential defense that the Navy could raise, which is a set-off. But for purposes of East Coast claims, the Tempest has nothing to do with it. Our claims arise out of a contract where we were promised that we would be paid a specific amount of money for doing specific work. We've never been paid that money. We've asked for that money to be paid. If the Navy wants to assert a set-off, and again, we don't think they can because we think they've waived any right to set off, they can try that in the hurricane case. But we're talking about two separate contracts, and the fact that the Navy unilaterally decided to assert a set off doesn't make one contract related to or arising out of another contract.
Well, and I understand that the court. Excuse me, I think that the Navy's argument is that you all settled this. And I understand your argument that there is some difference in the language of the settlement agreement entered into by the two parties. But we don't know the significance of that because we don't have anybody who signed on to the release talking about it. So we have to draw our own conclusions about this. And this discussion on page 257 helps us to do that.
Your Honor, there's no dispute that in the Tempest litigation, reference was made to these liquidated damages. I mean, it's on the page in front of you. I think we all agree that that reference was made in the underlying suit. But I think it's also telling that the word hurricane doesn't show up anywhere in the contract. My client came in and signed an agreement to settle
the
claims.
It doesn't show up anywhere in the contract because it was a settlement of the Tempest litigation.
Right.
Right. It was intended to settle the Tempest litigation, not any issues regarding the hurricane. My client continues to view these as separate contracts, and if the Navy wanted a release of the claims on the hurricane contract, it had to seek and have my client agree to release those claims.
What is your response to the observation that the district court made that there was a retainage expressly put into the terms of the contract, and there was no retainage with respect to this?
Your Honor, the reference to retainage is a specific contract term that was
Indeed.
Within the underlying contract.
But if there's a reservation for the retainage, and there's no reservation, express reservation like that for this.
And there needed to be a reservation for the retainage in the contract because it was releasing all the claims that were arising out of the Tempest. There was no reservation of rights regarding the retainage on the hurricane contract. There wasn't a reference at all to the hurricane contract, because the parties weren't intending to settle issues regarding the hurricane. The issues that were being settled were only those arising out of or related to the Tempest contract. And again, I caution the court, and we address this briefly within the briefs before the court, to interpret the rules differently, to determine that arising out of or related to one contract can mean a separate contract will have significant implications in the arbitration context and really any other context in which we see that term used. Because here, if you believe the Navy's position, their unilateral right to assert a set-off merges those contracts together. And so the language of arising out of related to one contract now actually refers to a separate contract. And that is a problematic rule going forward for those of us who try to draft contracts, specifically arbitration contracts, which almost always refer to claims relating to or arising out of a contract.
Mr. Paul, has the Federal Circuit tried to clarify this by saying that a claim to a set-off attaches to the underlying contract? Isn't there some case law from the Federal Circuit trying to clarify that point? If you're making a claim?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, what cases you're referring to. Okay. So I can't address that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So from your colleague now. Mr. DeLorio.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Mike DeLauro on behalf of the United States. Opposing counsel just said that the Navy never contested the underlying facts. That's simply incorrect. The facts were contested when the government filed its answer in the first Tempest case. No court ever ruled on those facts because the case was settled. But it's not as if we've ever agreed that the lateness of the redelivery was the Navy's fault or responsibility as opposed to East Coast's. The Navy's position steadfastly has been that the Tempest came back 84 days late and that it was entitled to this $474,000 worth of damages. But the focus isn't on the Hurricane contract, it's on the Tempest contract, because the Tempest contract was the basis for the setoff. And there's a sizable body of very straightforward law, which starts with that Supreme Court Muncie decision and carries forward in the Federal Circuit and the courts of federal claims cases, which says the government doesn't have
Mr. DeLauro, that all goes to the merits, and we want to hear the merits, but there's a threshold issue of jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So is the Navy's position still that the district court was correct, that there was no subject matter jurisdiction here?
The briefing that the government submitted wasn't consistent with the court's decision fully. Throughout the briefing, it's very clear that the first election wasn't in the ASBCA. The first election was in the first Tempest case. And we're talking about page 257 in the appendix. It's that paragraph 23 of the complaint in the earlier case. That was the initial election that brought this issue to a tribunal. It was then injected a second time with the filing of the motion, and now we have it a third time in this case. So our position would be that the election doctrine applies either going from the district court to the ASBCA or from the ASBCA to this, to the district court in this case. But it certainly has some effect. That's one thought. Another, Your Honor, is that East Coast keeps reframing this issue as being all about the Hurricane contract. And the point really is, we don't agree. It's really not about the Hurricane contract, but let's hold that thought for a second. If it is, then this issue should have been pursued in the ASBCA because it was introduced there. What we have really is a case of, I don't know, I guess it would probably qualify for what the Supreme Court calls drive-by
jurisdiction. So you're going to tell us whether we have subject matter jurisdiction or not at some point.
Yes, Your Honor, this court has subject matter jurisdiction.
Okay. All I need to know.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Its jurisdiction is derivative of the district courts, and the district court had the power to hear the case before it under the Suits and Admiralty Act and Public Vessels Act as modified by the Contract Disputes Act. And this court's jurisdiction is derivative of the district court's.
Well, so was there the district court didn't really have a choice because you're saying that it was the only place that had jurisdiction. Is that what you're saying?
I'm sorry.
Did you say that the agency also had jurisdiction? Both of them had jurisdiction? I'm just not sure I'm not trying to pick you up. I'm just not sure of your argument.
Yeah, no, Your Honor, I think I understand the question. Let me try. So the contractor has a choice at the outset. Forget that we've been to the ASBCA and the district court. Let's just go back to the beginning. The contractor can either, in this case, because it's a military contract, they can file a claim with the ASBCA, which is what they did in Hurricane,
right.
or they could go to the Court of Federal Claims, except that this is a maritime contract and there's this exception to the CDA, which puts such cases in the district court. but having picked the district court when it filed that complaint in December 2014, we submit that that's the first election. Nonetheless, we have this conundrum that's created by the filing in the ASPCA.
Yes, but your contention before us is that the district court had jurisdiction, and indeed it was the only place that had jurisdiction over this case. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right, Your Honor.
And it's spelled out, not in a given case, but it's this case spelled out because they elected it to begin with.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And that actually, if I could make a point that the court's not asking about, that's the difficulty that we have with that footnote finding about judicial estoppel.
Right.
In other words, when we filed the briefing, we had no way to know whether the district court was going to find the case, whether it was going to focus on the first Tempest case or on the ASBCA filing. We had no way to know that. And as it turned out, what I thought I was going to see was that the first filing was in the district court the first time. And instead, it looked like the district court didn't really question the ASBCA's jurisdiction, which I understand. And that was a question in our minds, because here the district court, it's not acting as an appellate body vis-a-vis the ASBCA. That's a concomitant court to which it owes some measure of comity. So the district court is put in a position where it's sort of being asked to make findings on a very sparse record in the ASBCA. And it's not surprising that Judge Wright didn't get into the issue.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
But on that point, isn't there a pretty well-established body of law that we relied on not too very long ago, that if you have a difficult jurisdictional question and you have some preliminary issue, like, for example, the one at issue here, which is res judicata collateral estoppel, you can go directly to the res judicata collateral estoppel issue and not worry about jurisdiction. The Supreme Court has said that, not with respect to res judicata, but with respect to preliminary arguments. Isn't that right?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. And so what we
have to determine whether there was jurisdiction or not, if we decided that the res judicata collateral estoppel issue was easier to decide, we could go directly there.
Yes, Your Honor. And to my appreciation, what we're seeing is a relaxation of the Supreme Court's Steel Company case.
Yeah.
In subsequent cases. And so if you have what we have here is a very straightforward grounds on res judicata. And this election doctrine is definitely in the mix, but it's a much more esoteric issue.
Yeah.
Okay. One thing I'd like to also take issue with in terms of opposing counsel's argument, they keep characterizing this as a defense, this set-off as a defense. The set-off is not a defense. It's an affirmative right. And it's an affirmative right that was fully executed before they ever filed their first complaint. In other words, if one looks at the sequence of events, there were two or three letters between the contracting officer and East Coast. And then East Coast filed a request for equitable adjustment, notifying the contracting officer that it took issue with the government's position, the Navy's position. And then we had a deemed denial. The Navy was working on it, but didn't quite get the response out. And so moving forward on this deemed denial, East Coast brought the lawsuit in December of 2014. At the time that lawsuit was brought, the government didn't file a counterclaim. It didn't assert set-off sort of as a defense. The set-off was done. The reason we see the count in the complaint, which seeks reversal of the set-off, the reason we see that in the record at 257, paragraph 23, is because at that point, it's East Coast's claim. And in fact, there's even language, I believe, in Muncie to the effect of a party can't jump back and forth in time. And that's kind of what's going on here. East Coast wants to say, well, it's a defense and the government waived it. It's not a defense. It's done when they filed their lawsuit.
So, but crucial to your race judicata argument, of course, is the release signed by both parties. And so maybe, and your colleague makes an argument that, okay, the language is different, and under Fourth Circuit law, we have to give significance to differences. So I know you don't know how we happen to get different language. It's very odd to me, but maybe you can address the releases.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, insofar as we can tell, the language is simply an artifact from an earlier release in some other case. Parties put together a release. There was no, you know, detailed back and forth that focused on this $473,000. And most assuredly, our office did not have the Treasury write a check for $2.5 million with the thought that probably we'd come back and litigate all over about another $500,000. But I would suggest this. I'm not sure that this framing is fair. This framing where we look at, well, here's the government's release and here's East Coast's right. release. The government's release doesn't matter because the government doesn't have a counterclaim in the first lawsuit. The only language that's important is in East Coast's release. And Judge Wright hits the nail on the head when she focuses on that. I think it's a rising under or something like that. That's the whole case right there, Your Honor. It's the res judicata issue.
Well, Mr. DeLario, let me ask you this. If East Coast had not included paragraph 23 in its complaint in the Tempest litigation, would that change your argument here?
I'm not sure that it would, Your Honor, because, in other words, East Coast has a very broad release. They're releasing any matters, known or unknown, suspected or unsuspected, foreseen or unforeseen, open or hidden. It's very, very broad language. And I would suggest to you that...
But all of that is arising out of the contract. And the
Tempest contract.
Out of the Tempest contract. And arguably, East Coast may have pleaded themselves out of relief through that paragraph because arguably they made the liquidated damages claim in the Tempest part of the Tempest contract by reason of their own pleading. It may be a moot point, but it seems like to me that that's a crucial prong of your argument.
Well, I don't. I mean, I appreciate the court's point, but I'm not sure I fully agree, and here's why. The law really doesn't smile upon claim splitting. This entire first Tempest lawsuit was about problems, a variety of, well, what East Coast saw as problems with the Tempest contract. That issue, if it wasn't in that complaint, I think we would argue had been waived. In any event, as you say, Your Honor, it is perhaps a moot point given the pleading. If there are no further questions from the court, I would relinquish the balance of my time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Unless colleagues have questions?
No.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your
argument. Thank you very much for your time.
I think I'd like to, if I could.
Sure.
I think I'd like to start by addressing the question of whether the setoff is an affirmative defense or not. We address that issue in the blue brief on page 20, citing two Fourth Circuit cases, both of which hold that a setoff is an affirmative defense. So this notion that East Coast is somehow trying to reframe this case doesn't accurately reflect the filings that were made below. The suit filed in this case is under the hurricane contract. It's a breach of contract claim, and the elements in no way rely upon anything having to do with the Tempest contract. What is being asserted here by the Navy is an affirmative defense. It's a setoff, and that issue has to be asserted by the Navy as a defense. It doesn't somehow undermine East Coast's case just because it exists. I understand that the court is focused on that footnote and that paragraph in the first Tempest suit, which does reference the fact that liquidated damages were held. But I think all that really does is reinforce the importance of the language of the settlement agreement, where the parties have different language to address their releases. And one of them addresses everything that was raised in the pleadings. And that was what the Navy was giving up. And if that language had been included in the release for East Coast, we wouldn't be here. But East Coast
Instead of comparing the two releases, maybe you can tell us what language in the release leaves the claim alive.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think that flips the question on its head.
I don't know that it does. I'm not interested because you're the only person. What was the Navy releasing?
What was the Navy releasing? Any other claims that it had on the related to the Tempest?
Have any claims.
Well, we don't know what claims the Navy could have or could not have asserted on the Tempest. So what my client was seeking...
Well, humor me for a moment and assume that you are the only person that's releasing anything, because the only thing that we have involved here is a claim that you did or did not release. That's the only thing that's issue in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so where is it that you reserved this argument in the release?
It was reserved by limiting the reverse to only those issues which are arising out of or related to the Tempest contract.
Okay.
I mean, the release was intended to put to bed the Tempest contract, to have that contract done and put to the side so my client could move on to the issues regarding the Hurricane contract. And that's exactly what we've done. We're not here suing on the Tempest contract. The Navy is the one that agreed that it could no longer assert any liquidated damages. It paid my client $2.5 million on the Tempest contract, because the delivery wasn't the fault of my client, it was the fault of the Navy. And that's the reason the money flew in that direction. Ultimately, this comes down to what is the claim before the district court? The claim before the district court is a breach of contract on the Hurricane contract. There is no defense to those claims. The Navy agreed to pay a set amount of money. My client performed the contract and they weren't paid. And the only way to avoid the clear breach of contract is if the Navy has an affirmative defense. And other than set off, which they clearly waived in the settlement agreement, they don't have any other affirmative defense explaining why they could not pay under the Hurricane contract. So what we'd ask this court to do is to reverse the lower court, both on the subject matter determination and on the underlying merits of the case, and instead award summary judgment to my client, East Coast Repair, who just wants the balance that's left on this Hurricane contract. And with that, I'll yield my time back.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your arguments, and we will take the case under submission. And I think do we want to take a short break here, my colleague?
Short recess, please.
Taking a short recess, and then we'll go to our third case. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This honorable court will take a brief recess before hearing the next case.